heard him pull himself up on the railing. The dog lay down and let out a theatrical sigh at each landing. There were open windows on every floor, but there was no breeze that night, and the air was hot and still. "I read that interview you gave a few years back," he said on the sixth floor. "That newspaper in Petoskey." "Yes." Clark was mopping his forehead with a handkerchief. "I want to talk to you about it tomorrow." On the ninth landing, Clark rapped a pattern with his cane on a door, and they were admitted into an octagonal room with walls of glass and arrays of darkened screens, four people with binoculars watching the tarmac, the terminal, the shadows of the gardens, the barrier fence. The dog sniffed around in the shadows. It was disorienting, being so high off the ground. The airplanes gleamed pale under the stars. The concert in Concourse C seemed to have ended. "Look there," Clark said, "to the south. It's what I wanted to show you." She followed the line of his finger to a space on the southern horizon where the stars seemed dimmer than elsewhere in the sky. "It appeared a week ago," he said. "It's the most extraordinary thing. I don't know how they did it on such a large scale."
"You don't know how who did what?"
"I'll show you. James, may we borrow the telescope?" James moved the tripod over, and Clark peered through, the lens aimed just below the dim spot in the sky. "I know you're tired tonight." He was adjusting the focus, his fingers stiff on the dial. "But I hope you'll agree this was worth the climb."
"What is it?"
He stepped back. "The telescope's focused," he said. "Don't move it. Just look through." Kirsten looked, but at first she couldn't comprehend what she was seeing. She stepped back.
"It isn't possible," she said.
"But there it is. Look again." In the distance, pinpricks of light arranged into a grid. There, plainly visible on the side of a hill some miles distant, a town or a village, whose streets were lit up with electricity. Chapter 52. Kirsten stares through the telescope at the town with electric light. In the terminal building, Charlie and August sit by Saeed's bed in the baggage claim infirmary and tell him about the concert, and he smiles for the first time in a number of days. 1,000 miles to the south of the airport, Jeevan is baking bread in an outdoor oven. He rarely thinks of his old life anymore, although he has dreams sometimes about a stage, an actor fallen in the shimmering snow, and other dreams where he's pushing shopping carts through blizzards. His small son kneels by his feet, playing with a puppy. This boy born into the new world, his mother resting indoors with the baby. "Frank," Jeevan says to his son, "go see if your mother's hungry." He lifts the pan with the bread from the oven, which in a previous incarnation was an oil drum. His son runs indoors, the puppy close at his heels. It's a warm night, and he hears a neighbor laughing. A scent of gardenias carries on the breeze. In a moment, he will go down to the river to retrieve the preserved meat cooling in an old coffee can in the water. He'll make sandwiches for his small family and offer some bread to their neighbors. But for now, he lingers to watch the silhouettes of his wife and children behind the thin curtains of the room where they live. Daria leans down to lift the baby from the crib, stoops again to blow out the candle, and in that movement she vanishes, the silhouettes blinking out, and Frank runs ahead of her out onto the grass. "Come check the bread," he says. And little Frank kneels by the bread with a grave expression, pokes at it with one finger, leans in close to inhale the warmth. "He seems better," Daria says. Frank had a fever the night before. She sang him soft lullabies while Jeevan pressed cold compresses to his forehead. "Back to normal," Jeevan says. "How's that bread looking, Frank?"
"I think it's too hot to eat."
"We'll let it sit for a moment." The boy turns to his parents, and for an instant in the twilight, he looks like his namesake, like Jeevan's brother. He comes to them, the moment already past, and Jeevan lifts him into his arms to kiss the silk of his hair. Always these memories, barely submerged. Far to the north, in a place so distant that in this flightless world it might as well be another planet, the caravans of the Traveling Symphony are arriving at the Severn City Airport. Part 9. Station 11. Chapter 53. On his last morning on Earth, Arthur was tired. He'd laid awake until sunrise and then drifted out of a twilight half-sleep in the late morning, sluggish and dehydrated, a throbbing headache behind his eyes. Orange juice would have helped, but when he looked in the fridge, there was only a mouthful left in the bottom of the carton. Why hadn't he bought more? He had had insomnia for the past 3 nights, and his exhaustion was such that this was enough to send him spiraling into something not far from fury, the fury contained with difficulty by breathing deeply and counting to 5, soothed by the cold air on his face. He closed the fridge door, made his last breakfast, scrambled eggs, and showered, dressed, combed his hair, left for the theater an hour early so he'd have time to linger with a newspaper over his second-to-last coffee at his favorite coffee place. All of the small details that comprise a morning. A life. The weather reports had been full of an approaching snowstorm, and he sensed it in the air, in the dove-gray weight of the late morning sky. He definitely decided. When Lear closed, he was moving to Israel. The idea was exhilarating. He would shed his obligations and belongings and start over in the same country as his son. He would buy an apartment within walking distance of Elizabeth's house, and he'd see Tyler every day. "Looks like snow," the girl in the coffee shop said. Arthur nodded hello to the hot dog guy who always stood on the same corner halfway between the hotel and the theater. The hot dog guy beamed. A pigeon walked in circles near the base of the hot dog stand, hoping for dropped garnishings and crumbs. The beauty of the pigeon's luminescent neck. He arrived at the theater at noon for notes, but the notes devolved into an extended argument and went on well past schedule. Arthur tried to pay attention, but the coffee wasn't performing as well as he'd hoped. In the late afternoon, he lay on a sofa in his dressing room, hoping to revive himself with a nap, but for all his exhaustion, the room seemed oppressive. His thoughts raced. He eventually gave up and left the theater. Ignoring the bored photographers outside the stage door, who took pictures and called out questions about Miranda while he waved at passing taxis, had he dragged her back into the tabloids when she'd visited 2 weeks ago? He felt the old guilt. She'd never asked for any of it. "Queen West and Spadina," he told the driver of an orange and green cab, and rested his forehead on the glass to watch their passage down Queen Street. This had been one of his neighborhoods once, but all the shops and cafes he'd known were gone. He was thinking of a diner near Queen West and Spadina, a place he'd frequented with Clark when they were 17. He couldn't recall exactly where it was, but he found it eventually, a little farther east than expected. All these decades later, the place was eerily unchanged. The same line of red upholstered booths, stools down the length of the counter, an ancient clock on the wall. Could this possibly be the same waitress? No, he was misremembering. Because the 50-ish woman who'd served him burnt coffee when he was 17 couldn't possibly still be 50-ish. He remembered being here with Clark at 3 or 4, or sometimes 5 in the morning, during what seemed at the time like adulthood, and seemed in retrospect like a dream. The dream lasted just a moment, but the moment was bright, both of them taking acting classes, Arthur working as a waiter while Clark burned through a small inheritance. Clark had been magnificent, actually, in retrospect. 6'2" and skinny, with a penchant for vintage suits, half his hair shaved off and the other half floppy and dyed pink, or occasionally turquoise or purple. Eyeshadow on special occasions, that captivating British boarding school drawl. Arthur's grilled cheese sandwich arrived. He thought of calling Clark, a quick, "You'll never guess where I'm calling from" moment, but decided against it. He wanted to call his son, but it was 4 a.m. in Israel. Arthur finished his dinner and took a cab back to the theater, where there was still a little time remaining. He sat on a sofa in his dressing room and looked over the script. He knew his lines backward and forward, but it was his habit to try to pick up some of everyone else's lines, too, because he liked to know what was coming. But before the end of the first act, there was a knock on the door. When he rose, the room didn't spin, exactly, but it wasn't as steady as it should have been. Tanya brushed past him into the room.
"You look like hell," she said. "Everything all right?"
"Tired," Arthur said. "I had insomnia again." He kissed her, and she perched on one of the sofas. The lightness he felt whenever he saw her. He was captivated, as always, by her excessive youth. She was slightly more than half his age. It was her job to look after the three little actresses who played child versions of Lear's daughters. "You forgot you were meeting me for breakfast, didn't you?" He slapped a hand to his forehead. "I'm so sorry. I'm not running on all cylinders today. How long did you wait?"
"Half hour."
"Why didn't you call me?"
"Dead cell phone battery," she said. "It's okay. You can make it up to me with a glass of wine."
This was something he adored about her, the way she let things go so easily. What a pleasant state of affairs, he'd been thinking lately, to be with a woman who didn't hold a grudge. He found a half-empty bottle of red in the fridge, she liked it cold, and noticed as he poured her glass that his hands were trembling.
"You really look terrible," she said. "Are you sure you're not sick?"
"Just tired, I think." He liked watching her drink wine, the way she concentrated on the taste. She had the appreciation for nice things that comes only from having grown up with little money.
"Do you have any of those chocolates left?"
"You know, I think I do." She smiled at him, the way her smile warmed him, and set her glass on the coffee table. After a few minutes of rummaging through the cupboard by the sink, she emerged triumphant with a small gold box. He selected a raspberry dark chocolate truffle.
"What's this?"
she asked, mid-chocolate, picking up Dr. 11, Volume 1, Number 1, Station 11, from the coffee table. "My ex-wife dropped those off a couple weeks back."
"Which one?"
He felt a flicker of sadness. This was a sign of having gone seriously astray, wasn't it? Having more than one ex-wife? He wasn't sure where exactly he'd gone wrong. "The first one, Miranda. I'm actually not sure what to do with them."
"What, you're not keeping these?"
"I don't read comic books," Arthur said. "She gave me two copies of each, so I sent the other set to my son."
"You told me you're trying to shed your possessions or something, right?"
"Exactly. They're lovely, but I don't want more things."
"I think I understand."
Tanya was reading. "Interesting storyline," she said a few pages in. "I don't know," he said. "I never really understood the point of it, to be honest." There was relief in admitting this to someone after all these years. The undersea, especially. All those people in limbo, waiting around, plotting. For what?
"I like it," Tanya said. "The art's really good, isn't it?"
She liked drawing more than she liked writing the dialogue. He was just now remembering this. Once he'd opened Miranda's study door and watched her work for some minutes before she realized he was there. The curve of her neck as she stooped over the drafting table, her absolute concentration. How vulnerable she'd seemed when she was lost in her work.
"It's beautiful."
Tanya was studying an image of the undersea, a heavily cross-hatched room with mahogany arches from Station 11's drowned forests. The room reminded Arthur of somewhere he'd been, but he couldn't place it.
She glanced at her watch. I should probably go. My little hellions are due in 15 minutes. Wait, I have something for you. A glass paperweight had arrived by courier 2 weeks ago, sent by Miranda from her hotel after he'd seen her. She'd explained in her note that Clark had brought it to the house in Los Angeles and that she regretted taking it, that she felt certain Clark had meant it for Arthur, not her. But when he held the glass lump in his hand, he found there were no memories attached to it. He had no recollection whatsoever of Clark having given it to them, and anyway, the last thing he wanted in his life was a paperweight. "It's gorgeous," Tanya said when he gave it to her. She peered into the cloudy depths. "Thank you." "I'll give you a call if Kirsten shows up here. Will I see you after the show?" She kissed him. "Of course," she said. When she was gone, he lay on the sofa and closed his eyes, but Kirsten was at his door 15 minutes later. His exhaustion was taking on the force of illness. Sweat beaded on his forehead when he stood. He let her in and sat down quickly. "My mom bought a book with you on the cover," she said. She sat across from him on the other sofa. The only book in existence with Arthur on the cover was Dear V. He felt nauseous. "Did you read it?"
"My mom won't let me read it. She says it's inappropriate."
"That's what she said? Inappropriate?"
"Yes."
"Well," Arthur said, "I think it's inappropriate that the book exists. She's right not to show it to you."
The one time he'd met Kirsten's mother, she'd cornered him to ask if he had any projects coming up with a part for a small girl. He'd wanted to shake her. "Your daughter's so young," he'd wanted to say. "Let her be a kid. Give her a chance. I don't know why you want this for her." He didn't understand why anyone would want their child involved in movies.
"Is the book bad?"
"I wish it didn't exist. But, you know, I'm glad you came by," he said.
"Why?"
"I have a present for you."
He felt a little guilty as he handed her the Dr. Eleven comics, because after all, Miranda had intended them for him. But he didn't want the comics, because he didn't want possessions. He didn't want anything except his son. When he was alone again, Arthur put on his costume. He sat for a few minutes in his finery, enjoying the weight of the velvet cape, left his crown on the coffee table next to the grapes, and walked down the hall to makeup. The pleasure of being with other people. He must have eaten something bad, he decided, maybe at the diner. He had an hour alone in his dressing room, where he drank chamomile tea and spoke lines aloud to his reflection in the mirror, paced, prodded at the bags under his eyes, adjusted his crown. At the half-hour call, he phoned Tanya. "I want to do something for you," he said. "This will seem very sudden, but I've been thinking about it for a week."
"What is it?"
She was distracted. He heard the three little girls bickering in the background. "How much do you still owe in student loans?" She had told him once, but he couldn't remember the number.
$47,000, she said,
and he heard the hope in her voice, the not daring to hope, the disbelief. "I want to pay it off." Wasn't this what money was for? This was what his life was going to mean, finally, after all these years of failing to win Oscars, this string of box office flops. He would be known as the man who gave his fortune away. He would retain only enough money to live on. He would buy an apartment in Jerusalem and see Tyler every day and start over.
"Arthur," she said,
"let me do this for you."
"Arthur, it's too much."
"It isn't." "How long will it take you to pay it off?" he asked gently, "at the rate you're going."
"I'll be in my mid-60s, but it's my debt. I..."
"Then let me help," he said. "No strings attached, I promise. Just come to my dressing room after the show tonight and let me give you a check."
"What do I tell my parents? If I tell them, they'll want to know how I got the money."
"Tell them the truth. Tell them an eccentric actor gave you a check for $47,000, no strings attached."
"I don't know how to thank you," she said.
When he ended the call, he felt an unexpected peace.
He would jettison everything that could possibly be thrown overboard, this weight of money and possessions, and in this casting off, he'd be a lighter man.
15 minutes, the stage manager called from just outside the door.
Thank you, 15,
Arthur said, and began running his lines from the beginning. At "Our eldest born speak first," he glanced at his watch. It was still only 6 a.m. in Israel, but he knew Tyler and Elizabeth got up early. He negotiated his way past his ex-wife.
2 minutes, Elizabeth. I know he's getting ready for school. I just want to hear his voice.
And closed his eyes to listen to the rustling of the telephone being transferred into his son's small hands. My eldest born, my only born, my heart.
Why are you calling?
That suspicious little voice. He remembered that Tyler was angry with him.
I wanted to say hello.
Then why weren't you here for my birthday? Arthur had promised to be in Jerusalem for Tyler's birthday, but he'd made that promise 10 months ago, and had frankly forgotten about it until Tyler had called him yesterday. Arthur's apologies hadn't landed.
I can't be there, buddy. I would if I could. But aren't you coming to New York soon? Won't I see you next week?
Tyler had nothing to say to this.
You're flying to New York tonight, aren't you?
I guess.
Did you read those comic books I sent you?
Tyler didn't respond. Arthur sat on the sofa and rested his forehead in the palm of his hand.
Did you like them, Tyler? Those comic books?
Yeah.
10 minutes, the stage manager said at the door.
Thank you, 10.
I looked at the comic books, Arthur said, but I don't think I completely understood what they were about. I was hoping maybe you could explain them to me.
What about them?
Well, tell me about Dr. 11.
He lives on a space station.
Really? A space station?
It's like a planet, but a little planet, Tyler said. Actually, it's sort of broken. It went through a wormhole, so it's hiding in deep space, but its systems were damaged, so on its surface, it's almost all water.
He was warming to his subject.
All water?
Arthur raised his head. It had been a mistake to let Tyler get so far away from him, but perhaps the mistake wasn't unfixable.
So they live in the water, Dr. 11 and his people?
They live on islands. They have a city that's all made of islands. There's like bridges and boats, but it's dangerous because of the seahorses.
The seahorses are dangerous?
They're not like the seahorses we saw in the jar in Chinatown that one time. They're big.
How big?
Really big. I think they're really big. They're like these huge things, and they ride up out of the water, and they've got eyes like fish, and they've got people riding on them, and they want to catch you.
What happens if a seahorse catches you?
Then it pulls you under, Tyler said, and then you belong to the undersea.
The undersea?
It's an underwater place.
He was talking fast now, caught up.
They're Dr. 11's enemies, but they're not really bad. They just want to go home.
Buddy, Arthur said. Tyler, I want you to know that I love you.
The silence was so long that he would have thought he'd lost the connection, if not for the sound of a passing car. The boy must be standing by an open window.
You too, Tyler said.
It was difficult to hear him. His voice was so small.
The door to his dressing room opened a crack.
5 minutes, the stage manager said.
Arthur waved in response.
Buddy, he said, I have to go now.
Are you doing a movie?
Not tonight, buddy. I'm going up on stage.
Okay. Bye,
Tyler said.
Goodbye.
I'll see you in New York next week.
Arthur disconnected and sat alone for a few minutes. He had a hard time meeting his own eyes in the dressing room mirror. He was very tired.
Places, the stage manager said.
The set for this production of Lear was magnificent. A high platform had been built at the back of the stage, painted to look like a balcony with elaborate pillars, stone from the front, bare plywood from the back. In the first act, the platform was the study of an aging king, and Arthur had to sit in a purple armchair while the house was filling up, in profile to the audience, holding his crown. A tired king at the end of his reign,
perhaps not as sharp as he had been, contemplating a disastrous division of his kingdom. Below, on the main stage, three small girls played a clapping game in soft lighting. At a cue from the stage manager, they rose and disappeared backstage left. The house lights dimmed, and this was Arthur's cue to stand and escape. He made his way into the wings in darkness, his path guided by a stagehand with a flashlight, just as Kent, Gloucester, and Edmund entered stage right.
"I don't get it," Arthur had said to the director, whose name was Quentin and who Arthur privately didn't like very much. "Why am I up there?"
"Well, you tell me," Quentin said. "You're pondering the vagaries of power, right? You're contemplating the division of England. You're thinking about your retirement savings. However you want to play it, just trust me. It's a good visual effect."
"So I'm up there because you like the way it looks."
"Try not to overthink it," Quentin said. But what was there to do up there on the platform if not think? On the opening night of previews, Arthur had sat in the chair as the house came in, listening to the whispers of the audience as they noticed him there, gazing at the crown in his hands, and he was surprised by how unsteady he felt. He'd done this before, this loitering on stage while the audience entered, but he realized that the last time he'd done this, he'd been 21 years old. He remembered having enjoyed it back then, the challenge of living in the world of the play before the play had properly started. But now, the lights were too close, too hot, and sweat poured down his back. In his first marriage, he and Miranda had gone to a Golden Globes party that had gone wrong at the end of the night. Miranda, who'd had perhaps one cocktail too many and wasn't used to high heels, had stumbled and sprained her ankle in a blaze of camera flashes as they were leaving, Arthur just out of reach, and he'd known as she fell that she was going to be a tabloid story. In those days, he knew a couple of actors whose careers had flamed out into an ashy half-life of rehab and divorces, and he knew what being a tabloid story could do to a person, the corrosive effect of that kind of scrutiny. He'd snapped at Miranda, mostly out of guilt, and they'd both said unpleasant things in the car. She'd stalked into the house without speaking to him. Later, he'd walked by the open bathroom door and heard her talking to herself as she removed her makeup. "I repent nothing," he'd heard her say to her reflection in the mirror. He'd turned and walked away, but the words stayed with him. Years later in Toronto, on the plywood second story of the King Lear set, the words clarified the problem. He found he was a man who repented almost everything, regrets crowding in around him like moths to a light. This was actually the main difference between 21 and 51, he decided, the sheer volume of regret. He had done some things he wasn't proud of. If Miranda was so unhappy in Hollywood, why hadn't he just taken her away from there? It wouldn't have been difficult. The way he'd dropped Miranda for Elizabeth and Elizabeth for Lydia and let Lydia slip away to someone else. The way he'd let Tyler be taken to the other side of the world. The way he'd spent his entire life chasing after something, money or fame or immortality or all of the above. He didn't really even know his only brother. How many friendships had he neglected until they'd faded out? On the first night of previews, he'd barely made it off the stage. On the second night, he'd arrived on the platform with a strategy. He stared at his crown and ran through a secret list of everything that was good. The pink magnolias in the backyard of the house in Los Angeles. Outdoor concerts, the way the sound rises up into the sky. Tyler in the bathtub at 2, laughing in a cloud of bubble bath. Elizabeth in the pool at night, at the beginning, before they'd ever had even a single fight, the way she dove in almost silently, the double moons on the surface breaking into shards. Dancing with Clark when they were both 18, their fake IDs in their pockets, Clark flickering in the strobe lights. Miranda's eyes, the way she looked at him when she was 25 and still loved him. His third wife, Lydia, doing yoga on the back patio in the mornings. The croissants at the cafe across the street from his hotel. Tanya sipping wine, her smile. Riding in his father's snowplow when he was 9, The time Arthur told a joke and his father and his little brother couldn't stop laughing. The sheer joy he'd felt at that moment. Tyler.
On the night of his last performance, Arthur was only halfway through the list when his cue came and it was time to exit. He followed the white tape arrow and the stagehand's flashlight and descended to stage right. He saw Tanya in the wings at the far side of the stage, herding the three little girls in the direction of the dressing rooms. She flashed him a smile, blew him a kiss. He blew a kiss back, why not, and ignored the murmurs that rose in the backstage area. Later, a woman from wardrobe placed a crown of flowers on his head. He was in his costume of rags for the mad scene. He saw Tanya across the stage again. Already in the final week of her life, the Georgia flu so close now, and then a stagehand appeared near him, holding Kirsten's hand.
"Hi," Kirsten whispered. "I love the comic books."
"You read them already?"
"I just had time to read the beginning."
"Here's my cue," he whispered. "I'll talk to you later." And he wandered out into the sound effect storm. "But who comes here?" the man playing Edgar said. In 4 days, he would be dead of flu. "The safer sense will ne'er accommodate his master thus." "No, they cannot arrest me for coining," Arthur said, bungling the line.
"Focus," he told himself, but he was scattered, a little dizzy.
"I am the king himself." "Oh," Edgar said, "thou side-piercing sight." Gloucester raised a hand to his gauze-covered eyes. In 7 days, he would die of exposure on a highway in Quebec. Arthur was having trouble catching his breath. He heard a shimmer of harp music, and then the children were there, the girls who'd been his daughters at the beginning, hallucinations of themselves, little ghosts. 2 of them would die of flu on Tuesday of next week, one in the morning and one in the late afternoon. The 3rd, Kirsten, flitted behind a pillar.
"Down from the waist they are centaurs," Arthur said, and this was when it happened. A sharp pain, a clenching, a weight on his chest. He staggered and reached for the plywood pillar that he knew was somewhere close, but he misjudged the distance and struck his hand hard against the wood. He held his hand to his chest, and it seemed to him that he'd done this before, something familiar in the motion. When he was 7 years old on Delano Island, he and his brother had found a wounded bird on the beach. "The wren goes to it," Arthur said, thinking of the bird. But to his own ears, his voice sounded choked, Edgar looking at him in a way that made him wonder if he'd flubbed the line. He was so lightheaded now. "The wren." A man in the front row was rising from his seat. Arthur cradled his hand to his heart, exactly as he'd held the bird. He wasn't sure where he was anymore, or perhaps he was in 2 places at once. He could hear the waves on the beach. The stage lights were leaving trails through the darkness the way a comet had once, when he was a teenager, standing on the dirt outside his friend Victoria's house, looking up at the night. Comet Hyakutake suspended like a lantern in the cold sky. What he remembered from that day at the beach when he was 7 was that the bird's heart had stopped in the palm of his hand, a fluttering that faltered and went still. The man from the front row was running now, and Arthur was in motion too. He fell against the pillar and began to slide, and now snow was falling all around him, shining in the lights. He thought it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen.
Chapter 54. In Dr. Eleven, Volume 1, Number 2, The Pursuit, Dr. Eleven is visited by the ghost of his mentor, Captain Lonigan, recently killed by an undersea assassin. Miranda discarded 15 versions of this image before she felt that she had the ghost exactly right, working hour upon hour. And years later, at the end, delirious on an empty beach on the coast of Malaysia, with seabirds rising and plummeting through the air, and a line of ships fading out on the horizon. This was the image she kept thinking of, drifting away from and then toward it, and then slipping somehow through the frame. The captain is rendered in delicate watercolors, a translucent silhouette in the dim light of Dr. Eleven's office.
which is identical to the administrative area in Lyon Provence Toronto office suite, down to the two staplers on the desk. The difference is that Lyon Provence office had a view over the placid expanse of Lake Ontario, whereas Dr. Eleven's office window looks out over the city, rocky islands and bridges arching over harbors. The Pomeranian, Luli, is curled asleep in a corner of the frame. Two patches of office are obscured by dialogue bubbles. Dr. Eleven. What was it like for you, at the end?
Captain Lonigan.
It was exactly like waking up from a dream. Chapter 55. The Traveling Symphony left the airport on a bright morning in September. They'd stayed for 5 weeks, resting and making repairs to the caravans, performing Shakespeare and music on alternate evenings, and an orchestral and theatrical hangover lingered in their wake. That afternoon, Garrett hummed a Brandenburg concerto while he worked in the gardens. Dolores whispered fragments of Shakespeare to herself while she swept the concourse floors. The children practiced swordplay with sticks. Clark retreated to the museum. He ran a feather duster over his objects and thought of the symphony moving away down the coast, carrying their Shakespeare and their weapons and music. Yesterday, Kirsten had given him one of the two Dr. Eleven comics. He could see that it pained her to part with it, but the symphony was passing into unknown territory, and she wanted to ensure that at least one of the comics would be safe in case of trouble on the road.
"As far as I know, the direction you're going is perfectly safe," Clark told her. He'd assured the conductor of the same thing a few days earlier.
"Traders come up from there sometimes." "But it's not our usual territory," Kirsten said, and if Clark hadn't come to know her a little, over the weeks when the symphony had lived in Concourse A and performed music or Shakespeare every night, he might not have caught the excitement in her voice. She was beside herself with impatience to see the far southern town with the electrical grid. "When we come back through, I'll take this one back and leave you with the other one. That way, at least one book will always be safe." In the early evening, Clark finishes dusting his beloved objects in the Museum of Civilization and settles into his favorite armchair to read through The Adventures of Dr. Eleven by candlelight. He pauses over a scene of a dinner party on Station Eleven. There's something familiar about it. A woman with square-framed glasses is reminiscing about life on Earth. "I traveled the world before the war," she says. "I spent some time in the Czech Republic, you know. In Praha." And tears come to his eyes, because all at once he recognizes the dinner party. He was there. He remembers the Praha woman, her glasses and her pretension. The man sitting beside her bears a passing resemblance to Clark. The blonde woman at the far end of the comic book table is unmistakably Elizabeth Colton, and the man beyond her in the shadows looks a little like Arthur. Once Clark sat with all of them in Los Angeles, at a table under electric light. On the page only Miranda is missing, her chair taken by Dr. Eleven. In the comic book version, Dr. Eleven sits with his arms crossed, not listening to the conversation, lost in thought. In Clark's memory, the caterers are pouring wine, and he feels such affection for them, for all of them. The caterers, the hosts, the guests. Even Arthur, who is behaving disgracefully. Even Arthur's orange-tanned lawyer, the woman who said Praha instead of Prague, the dog peering in through the glass. At the far end of the table, Elizabeth is gazing into her wine. In memory, Miranda excuses herself and rises, and he watches her slip out into the night. He's curious about her and wants to know her better, so he tells the others he needs a cigarette and follows her. What became of Miranda? He hasn't thought of her in so long. All these ghosts. She went into shipping, he remembers. Clark looks up at the evening activity on the tarmac, at the planes that have been grounded for 20 years, the reflection of his candle flickering in the glass. He has no expectation of seeing an airplane rise again in his lifetime. But is it possible that somewhere there are ships setting out? If there are again towns with streetlights, if there are symphonies and newspapers, then what else might this awakening world contain? Perhaps vessels are setting out even now, traveling toward or away from him, steered by sailors armed with maps and knowledge of the stars, driven by need, or perhaps simply curiosity, whatever became of the countries on the other side. If nothing else, it's pleasant to consider the possibility. He likes the thought of ships moving over the water, toward another world, just out of sight. This is Kirsten Potter. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. This program was produced by Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2014 by Emily St. John Mandel. Production copyright 2014 Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.